Good evening.
Good evening.
We have a couple of faces that we haven't seen for a while. Very happy to see Roman back and Paul. Yay. So let's do introductions around. I'm not sure everybody knows everybody.
Judy, Wendy, Ellie, Leslie,
Mimi.
Steve. Yeah.
Paul. Jeffrey.
Ron.
Karen.
So we skipped a week. And I'm sorry for those who didn't get the announcement and came anyway. It's on Yahoo, so if you're not in the Yahoo, I don't even know what it is. Wendy, you could say what it is.
What, the Yahoo group?
Where the announcements come from.
You just need to give your email to me. That's the easiest way.
Good. Okay. So, we're still in the introduction, believe it or not. And the introduction is probably the whole thing, in a way. This is establishing how we understand the self and suffering, which was Buddha's first noble truth. And this is the Dalai Lama's explanation, which is very clear and complete, according to the Mahayana tradition. There are other traditions that explain it in other ways, but basically it's the same teaching, that if we cling to things and identify them as fixed, we suffer. And if we cling to ourself as a fixed thing, we suffer. So then, of course, what is this if it's not a self? But what is happening? And that's the story, really. It's happening. It's not a thing to be someone. It's an occurrence. It's a continual action that's based on everything that is happening. So that when we say we're all connected, it means that we're affected by everything that's going on. And we know that because we read the newspaper and we read that there's a fire down there and we look out and there's the smoke and suddenly we're breathing smoke and we are affected by something that happened far, far away. But it's us. It becomes us. So that you could say the five skandhas are little streams of feelings and impressions and thoughts and ideas all coming into us and going out from us continually. Constantly going, going, going. So we're always different. We're changing our mind all the time. Even though we think we don't change our mind, we have changed vastly since 30 years ago, for instance. We do not even think the same, much less look the same. So we're amazing creatures. It's like, I think if Walt Disney made an image of this, it would just be streams of different colors all streaming around each other and flowing out into other streams and then flowing back in. We could never identify exactly how it all worked. But it's a beautiful thing. He says, when you realize that everything we perceive and experience arises as a result of the interaction and coming together of causes and conditions, your whole view changes. Your perspective on your own inner experiences and the world at large shifts as you begin to see everything in terms of this causal principle. So things happen, and then we get affected by whatever happens, and we say, well, why did that happen? And be mad at it, and kick the tire that isn't working right, or yell at the kids, or do something to blame something else for what's happening. But Dalai Lama is suggesting that we just stop and think, oh, I wonder what made this happen. It's a scientific mind, really. It's a questioning mind and a curious mind. So that if we're in relationship and it's troubled, instead of just casting blame here and there in the middle of it, it helps tremendously to sit down together and figure it out. I read recently that somebody said a wandering mind is what the human mind does. It's a wandering mind. If we just sit and let ourselves spin, it just goes blah, 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 blah. We know that because we do that in Zazen. He said, a wandering mind always goes to the unhappy place. And I've been testing that. I've been walking around wondering if that's really true. And it seems to be, in my life, it seems to be true. That if there's nothing particular to think about, you start griping and complaining about things. Oh, it shouldn't be like that, and the government is blah, 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 and it just goes on and on and on. So in those terms, what we call in Zen training the mind is just learning how to think clearly and to understand better. We'll never really understand ourselves or anybody else, but we can allow the situation, whatever it is, to be a complexity that we can allow to be the way it is. That it's a complexity, not a single thing, and nothing that we can hold on to. It will change whatever it is. This is big words in here. Once we appreciate that fundamental disparity between appearance and reality, that things aren't the way they appear to the wandering mind, it's when the mind stops and really looks that it begins to experience the reality of things. We gain a certain insight into the way our emotions work and how we react to events and objects. Underlying the strong emotional responses we have to situations, we see that there is an assumption that some kind of independently existing reality exists out there. In this way, we develop an insight into the various functions of the mind and the different levels of consciousness within us. And we grow to understand that though certain types of mental or emotional states seem so real, in reality, they are mere illusions. It's all made up. like to think that way. We don't like to take that. My feelings are really important to me. I just don't want to think like that. But if I really think about it, all the things that I emote about right here, right now, mean nothing at all. Nothing. It's gone. Where'd it go? Oh, gone. We can revert to our memory, and we do, of course, and we can massage our memories and make it even more if we want to. We can really build up a whole picture and a construction of a story that will keep us amused and interested for years sometimes. What Aunt Susie said to Uncle John, you know, it can go on and on. Through a whole family, through generations even. It's how an untrained mind lives in the world. And there's a lot of hurt in it. It's this type of reflection, he says, and analysis, that we'll be able to gain an insight into what in technical Buddhist language is called the origin of suffering. In other words, these emotional experiences that lead to confusion and misapprehension and afflict the mind. When this is combined with an understanding of the interdependent nature of reality at the subtlest level, then we also gain insight into what we call the empty nature of reality, by which we mean the way each and every object and event arises only as a combination of many factors and has no independent or autonomous existence. It's a mind-blowing view. And this includes ourself. And this is how our problem of facing our situation as human being, mammals, animals, being born to die, is so crucial to understand. It's a very odd situation we were born into. And it's our challenge to face that and come to some kind of agreement about it, or we will suffer. Says, by understanding dependent origination, we see the Dharma. When we see the Dharma, we are understanding dependent origination. It's all of a piece. And it's all on its way. It's all flowing. Although as we sit, we're always right here. Wherever we are, we're always right here. So time has two different aspects. The running around time and the actual time, which is, you could call it eternal time, which is always the time in which we live and breathe. The only actual right now time. That all by itself is so mysterious. So then people asked him questions. And this is still in the introduction, but based on this exposition that he's had about the... well, he also introduces the two truths, and I should mention that, although people say, but life is just like this. It's not, you can't see it flowing. It's just, this is, I had a friend who used to say, this is my hand, right here. Or Dr. Johnson kicked a rock when he read Bishop Berkeley's exposition of this, that things are unreal, they're all illusions. And so then they posit that it's two truths. And some Zen studies and some Zen teachers think this is important to help people understand these ideas, and some don't, and I'm one of the don't people. I think we're pretty smart. We can get it without pretending that they're two things. If form is emptiness and emptiness is form, you can't say it's two. You can't say it's one either. You shouldn't have to say anything about it. It's just what it is. And we have to put up with it both ways. So he recommends critical thinking, critical reasoning, even if it casts a doubt in your mind as to the permanence of things, it can make an impact. So if you really start thinking critically about things, you can try to understand, well, some things are permanent, aren't they? Some things are around forever, aren't they? But if you think about it clearly, you have to see, no. It doesn't feel like that, but that's the way it is. And we have all the science to make it very clear to us now. We can't pretend. So we have, it has the effect of loosening the grip on the idea that things are permanent or eternal. Critical reasoning points you toward the impermanence of things. So with constant reflection, you understand it. And the enhancement of our good heart, he recommends. That's very, very, very helpful, especially if you take this seriously. It really is breathtaking. But if you remember the goodness of your own self, once you really touch that place, you know the goodness in everyone else too. And the goodness in life itself. So he said you have to develop some intellectual understanding of what compassion is. I'm not sure you have to do that, but it's kind of fun to have this instruction. You have to have some notion of how it could be enhanced. So then you gain some kind of simulated experience of your good heart. So he's saying, even if you don't feel your goodness, live that way anyway. Just do it. And actually, they're doing all kinds of experiments on that now and finding that that is the way it is. As soon as we begin to try, our life changes. And it actually becomes compassionate. Jack Kornfeld's favorite story, which I've told many times, is mine too, about this. that he first went to Bodh Gaya of all places to practice, and hooked up with I've forgotten what the school is, but some Buddhist school of monks who sort of take care of the Dalai Lama, of the enlightenment place of Buddha. There's a big tree, there's a big shrine, there are things all around. And these monks who take care of things. And so Jack Kornfield stayed in the house across the street from the enlightenment tree. And there was an ugly little old shriveled up, bent over gardener who was taking care of the place, the monastery. And his teacher told him to just send a compassionate thought about this little old gardener who Jack thought was really kind of ick and nothing. It was just this little person that he didn't even know. And he still kept giving him metta, loving kindness, every time he saw him, because the monk told him that's what he should do if he wanted to be a Buddhist. And he said after a couple of weeks, he adored this man. He really, really loved him because he really, really saw him. And of course it changed him too. It changed that little man to have that kind of attention paid to him. It's not complicated. It's just that it's hard for us to do, to think, to want to do often, because we're so defended. He talks about going to refuge. A deep conviction in the Dharma is a precondition for developing faith and respect in the Buddha and the Sangha. And that's really it with the introduction. There's a lot more material, but it's mostly saying just about that. He tells a story at the end about no, I'm not even going to tell it. It's not, that's a strange story. So I'm going to call the introduction finished. And there's time for questions and discussion. Yep.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about a comment that you made in the beginning, or that the Dalai Lama was saying, that the wandering mind goes to the unhappy place. Because it confuses me a little bit too, since when we sit, I feel like that's what my mind does. Or is it something else?
Well, if you keep coming back to where you are, mm-hmm. it's not wandering. I mean, it does wander, mm-hmm. and practice is to come back. Mm-hmm. So, there's some discipline involved in the wandering. If you just lie down in the grass mm-hmm. and look at the clouds and just dream, then that's the wandering mind that it's talking about.
Okay. So what would be the instruction to someone who wanders when they're learning how to sit? when they say, what do I do with my mind?
Just keep coming back to your breath. Just keep coming back to who you are and where you are. Because that's the only truth, the only reality. It's not some fancy kind of idea. It's just the root of the reality of it. And once you're embodied as this, then suddenly you're empowered in a way that you're not if your mind is just wandering out and blah, and in, even in bliss, that's a wander too. So the whole idea is simply to come and sit down and be here.
Because that's, because that's a little bit more of a disciplined approach compared to some, you know, other things that I've heard over the past years, you know?
Yeah. It's called having an open mind. So we tend to boss our mind around. We tend to have an idea about how we think, and tell it how to think, and tell it what our values are, and all the while, something else is going on in us. Some more true thing. And it's this bossy one that's gets tired when we sit. It just gets sick and tired of doing what it's doing and kind of takes a nap. And then we feel a connection on another level, a whole nother different level.
Karen? I wanted to jump in on that same point because that also jumped out at me, that the suggestion was that this sort of fallback to the negative was kind of more of the natural state of mind. But I, it sort of ran counter to what I feel. I've been trying to integrate my Zen practice and my yoga practice a little bit and just try to understand where they're similar, when I'm after a yoga class, it seems like, oh, this is more the natural state, or it feels like, and it's very breath oriented and in the moment oriented as well, but somehow I've addressed these pains in my body in some way.
Yeah.
And then sort of at the end, I'm much more open and softer and, you know, flexible and able to be more present.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought, oh, this is our natural. This is what, without all the tightness, this is what we're meant to be.
So when you're sitting, you should be relaxed.
Right.
And we don't relax, usually. We're trying so hard that we get, you know, our back is hurting and our knees are hurting and we're trying so hard. You don't have to do that. If you're just going to be here, you can just be here. Oh, thank goodness I'm here. I'm still here. Oh, look at that, I'm still here. This is great. They work together beautifully. Yeah. Yeah.
I like this point about long. I was wandering. I have a book on my phone, but it's impossible to browse through it.
So oh,
I'm
yes.
guilty of the wandering mind through this book, but I thought that the point about wandering was very much related to his idea of these emotional states. It's almost, he's not exactly saying devil finds work for idle hands, but a similar kind of process. If you don't control your mind and just settle it down, it's gonna flip from thought to thought and memory to memory and karmic residue to karmic residue, and it's probably you're gonna get
all mixed up,
worked up, and somehow excited about whatever it is your mind lands on.
Yes.
So it's but it's a good added just for our day to day, you know, because stuff is always, all day long, crazy stuff. Some guy followed me to the post office the other day because I didn't see him coming at me just so that he could make a rude gesture at me. Why is this guy, doesn't he have something better to do? Can't he just get a life? For him, I guess, it was pretty important. It made me kind of unhappy. But anyway, I let it go. But the point is, all day long, this crazy stuff's happening. People are racing around, all agitated, stressed out, in a hurry, late for something, worried about where they're supposed to get to instead of where they are right now. Same with meditation.
It's true. It's true. It's a hard life here in Silicon Valley.
Anywhere, though, really.
Anywhere, yes, but here it's so fast.
I think it's human nature, so it's largely a process of just settling down over the years.
Yeah. Well, all those emotional problems are called the kleshas, the greed and the anxiety and the jealousy and all those things that we just are like that. And getting to be familiar with how our mind is working, how our emotions work, is extremely helpful.
I'm thinking about this scientist that I listen to often, talking about from an evolutionary standpoint, the mind, the human mind, is supposed to be was meant to be dissatisfied, not meant to be, was dissatisfied, and that was part of the of how it left where it was to go find more and better, and was this natural state of dissatisfaction.
Mm.
But fast forward to now, we don't need to be dissatisfied.
Mm.
We need to take the next evolutionary step to become, to have the satisfied mind.
Yes.
And to be to no longer have to go somewhere else to find, but to just be settled in the moment.
And I like
to think of, to help me evolve in that way, I like to think of my mind, I heard Vanya say this, my mind's like a gland. I've heard her say that.
Yes.
I like that imagery where it's secreting thoughts.
Yeah.
They really have no purpose. They're
right.
My gland is more active than most people.
You got that from Uchiyama Roshi.
Yeah, I like that. It works really well for me.
It does work, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
There it is, more of that stuff going on.
Change the perspective, and suddenly things become clear.
Yes.
And sitting is very difficult. And I don't know if I should say difficult, but to me it's a chess match with myself. you know, put my knee here, put my leg there, sit at this level, you know, change levels. But it's the sutra studying that I really come alive. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was wrong at first. Until I read a koan about a monk who was sent away and was doing some work program, kicked a rock and enlightened. You know, so I think for me, I'm just a little bit different of a character.
I see. Have you tried sitting a longer time?
Yeah. I tried a few times, and it worked really well to sit longer periods. I just can't find the time.
Well, there is that. That's the hard part.
Yeah. When I'm like just, I should have thought a long time ago about maybe stacking myself, you know, in more of a favorable position, but I didn't know any better.
Right. Live and learn.
You know, I sit 10 minutes a day, but I sit every day.
Right. Well, if the occasion ever happens that you have a chance to sit longer, I mean, days longer, it's very beneficial.
I sat for 3 days with Ian. That was killer.
Mm-hmm. The first 3 days are not easy.
Yeah.
After that, it gets easy.
Yeah. It's all the time I get off work.
Well,
thank you.
It's a little after 8, so we should stop. we're having an all-day sit on Saturday, which all by itself is longer than what we're used to sitting here. So, of course, the Zendo is open all day long, and there'll be Doksan in the morning, anybody who wants to sign up. And a talk at 1 o'clock and a break for lunch between 12 and 1. So we'll sit between 9 and 4. Is there anything else?
Yes, we need a volunteer to open. So if you think you can help enable this sit by coming here at 8:30 on Saturday morning, you'll see me. And if you didn't get an announcement about this Saturday sit, then we need your email address.
Okay.
Yeah. Because our flyer for Sashin is going out very soon, and you want to get that.
Do our 1 minute sit.